This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. the second. Hey, Carrie.
How you doing, Stephen?
So I have been absolutely horrified in recent years by the photos that we see constantly about immigration. People clamoring to get over walls, people crossing rivers, children trying to get into the country and being separated from their parents and their families, or kept in some cases in cages, something you just couldn't fathom. And the thing that jumps out to me, the word that jumps into my head constantly is cruelty, that this is a cruel dynamic and process in our country. And that's so antithetical to the idea of our country, but also to the idea of immigration. You think of those words that are inscribed on the Statue of Liberty about the huddled masses yearning to be free and the wretched coming to our shores. This doesn't look anything like what that aspires to.
Yeah, and there's a lack of understanding of how it operates. Like, I myself can admit to it as well. Like, I'm not 100% sure how this all operates. And I think it's always worth it.
Like, what are the rules?
What are the rules, right? Yeah. Who comes? What are the circumstances? How long you get to stay? All that sort of stuff. But I mean, I think we can all agree that opportunity is something that we all want folks to have. And we think that this is a land of opportunity. So trying to figure that out has to be pretty crucial to us. So
yeah.
What does that inspire for the conversation for today?
So, you know, for me, questions like this always invoke a thought about, well, what was the original idea here? What was the original intent? And I think we're talking about something like immigration in the United States. You got to talk about the Constitution.
Back here again.
What does it say about immigration? Yeah. What does it say about who should be able to be an American? And so,
and what do they mean back then, or what do we interpret it to mean back then, and how that applies now, and has it changed? Yeah. So, who do you want to have speak on this for this episode today?
So, we had this conversation a few years ago as part of the Detroit Today book club. We'd choose a theme that fit under the Created Equal umbrella that was about inequality or opportunity. That summer, we were talking about the Constitution, of all things. And we had a conversation with Christina Rodriguez, who is a law professor at Yale, and Ilya Soman, who is a law professor at George Mason, about what the Constitution actually says about immigration. How does it frame this question for this new country back then?
Was there anything particularly happening in 2021 that inspired that conversation, or was it just part of the series of constitutional conversations?
Well, we've had this immigration crisis going on for a long time. And my memory is that in 2021, which is after the 2020 presidential election in particular, you started to see this surge of people coming to the southern border in particular, because Joe Biden changed a lot of the immigration policies that Donald Trump had put into place. And there was a lot of blame being hurled about what was happening to these people, what was happening to the border guards, and how you could process all of this at once. It was the beginning of what we're seeing now in 2024, which is that becoming an election issue, right? How Joe Biden as president has handled this issue is something that the GOP is really attacking him over.
Well, let's get into it.
It's a great conversation. The concept of equal opportunity in America has always been wrapped somewhat around the idea that immigrants to our country will all be welcomed on a fair basis. But from the beginning, the Constitution, as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court, has tolerated so many instances in which that opportunity has been compromised by bias and by discrimination. So the question is, do immigrants to this country enjoy the same equal protection as other Americans? And should they? That's where we begin the conversation today. And we've got two really wonderful wonderful guests here, experts to help us sort through how immigration plays out in the context of the U.S. Constitution. Christina Rodriguez is a professor of law at Yale Law School, and her expertise includes constitutional law and theory and immigration law and policy. She's also author of the book, The President and Immigration Law. Christina Rodriguez, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. And also with us is Ilya Soman, who is a professor of law at George Mason University. His expertise includes constitutional law and immigration rights. He's author of the book Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. Ilya Soman, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So I'm going to start here. I would love to have both of you address how the U.S. Constitution addresses immigration and how its framing of this issue has kind of cast forward as we've gotten into the life of this country and the various controversies that have arisen over time. Professor Rodriguez, I am going to start with you.
The Constitution itself says very little about immigration. It does give Congress the power to adopt a uniform rule of naturalization, which is the path to citizenship. So those who wrote it clearly contemplated that there would be immigration, but that is the only place where you see that expressly identified. Today, the thought is that Congress's power to regulate immigration could come from any number of parts of the Constitution, the power to regulate international foreign commerce, the power to regulate interstate commerce. The Supreme Court has also found it to be a power that is effectively inherent in the idea of a nation. A nation has to be able to control its borders to remain sovereign. And so in that sense, the power of Congress to regulate is relatively uncontroversial today. Most of the constitutional controversy has moved to the extent to which the Constitution might limit what Congress and the executive or the states, for that matter, do in their efforts to regulate immigration and the lives of immigrants. And that's where the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause and the 14th Amendment protections for due process and equal protection come into play. And a lot of the ferment revolves around how to interpret those provisions.
Hmm. Professor Soman, I wonder what your take is on the Constitution and immigration.
Yeah, I largely agree with what Christina just said, but I would add that it's notable that nowhere in the Constitution is there listed any general power of the federal government to restrict immigration, even though the Constitution enumerates all sorts of other less significant powers. So many of the founding fathers, including James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, actually argued that the federal government did not have any general power to restrict immigration. And this was actually the dominant view held by people in the first several decades, at least after the establishment of the Constitution. And it was only in 1889, in the Chinese exclusion cases, that the Supreme Court ruled that there was actually a power to restrict immigration. And that shift in thinking was in large part the result of a rise in bigotry against Chinese and other Asian immigrants, thus leading to the Chinese Exclusion Act, which the court upheld. So it's true today we take for granted that Congress has the power to restrict immigration and that the president has a lot of power in this area too. But it's not at all clear that this is actually true, at least according to the original meaning of the Constitution. And the shift in opinion which led people to take for granted that it's true had a great deal to do with racism in the late 19th century.
Mm. So I want to go back just a bit to the founding itself and the conversations that the founders were having about the new nation they were building and the Constitution that they were designing to govern that nation. How much of what they were discussing was about who could be an American and who couldn't be an American, which is really, I think, the fundamental question when you're talking about immigration. And I think going back to that point and talking about what they thought about those things helps us understand the history of immigration in the country and the ways in which inequality, the same inequality that frames so much of the rest of the Constitution and the forming of the nation, has really influenced that idea of who gets to be an American, why, and who doesn't. Professor Rodriguez, talk about what many of the founders believed about the idea of who should be able to be a newcomer to the new nation.
So there are a number of different ways of looking at that question. One of the earliest constitutional controversies was over the Alien and Sedition Acts, mm-hmm. that were designed to enable the Federalists to crack down on their political opponents, but also contained a law that authorized the president to expel any immigrant he deemed a threat to public safety or to the nation. It was enormously controversial law. Both James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and many others thought that it was a violation of the separation of powers, that there was no such power to delegate to the president. It was motivated by a concern that French immigrants in particular were threats to the political power of the Federalist Party. They sympathized with Thomas Jefferson, and so immigration from the very beginning was used as a political tool to try to prevent people who were thought not to be fully loyal to the United States from remaining in the country. There were also restrictions placed on naturalization. The length of time it took to naturalize during that period was extended to 12 years, which was a way of trying to prevent immigrants from becoming voters, particularly those who were thought to be threats. The other way of looking at this question from the early period of American history is that a lot of the regulation of migration occurred indirectly through decisions that the states made about who they wanted to attract to their territories and who they essentially wanted to kick out. So there was a lot of variation in the kinds of immigrants that different parts of the country thought were desirable or not desirable. So in what is now the Midwest, in the antebellum period, the period before the Civil War, there were state laws that sought to attract immigrants, that land grants and guarantees of even voting, and efforts to make it attractive so that immigrants who were mostly coming from Europe at the time would come to the Midwest to settle it. Those were predominantly German immigrants. But on the Eastern Seaboard, which at this period was relatively developed compared to the West, there was a lot of resentment and hostility towards the migrants who were coming in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, primarily to the Irish, who were perceived as poor, who were poor and were perceived as brains on the public interest and the public fisc. And so there were states, including New York and Massachusetts, that tried to adopt their own deportation laws as a way of keeping the Irish in particular out because they were seen to be either unassimilable or drained on the system. And so the early history and practice of whether immigrants were welcomed or not was quite varied and had a lot to do with the development needs of the different parts of the country. Hmm.
Professor Soman, are we wrong to ascribe to, I guess, the early America even the idea of equality when it comes to something like immigration, the same way we might be wrong to ascribe too much to early America in terms of equality in other realms? In other words, does immigration, I guess, fall prey to the same kinds of shortcomings when we think of equality that other provisions of the Constitution did?
So I think in this area, as in a number of others, the founding fathers outlined very strong and idealistic principles of equality that weren't always lived up to. So George Washington, for instance, said that the United States should be an asylum for the poor and oppressed of all nations and religions. Thomas Jefferson, Madison, James Wilson, and other founders said similar things. And obviously, those principles weren't always adhered to. There was the Alien Act of 1798, which Christina mentioned, though it's worth noting that Madison and Jefferson, many others, resisted it. argued that it was unconstitutional, and eventually it was allowed to expire without a single person ever actually being deported under it. And obviously, as Christine also mentioned, there were some exclusionary rules adopted by state governments. Indeed, for the first 100 years of American history, most immigration restrictions were almost entirely by the states rather than by the federal government. There certainly also, of course, was various kinds of bigotry against immigrants, Irish immigrants, German immigrants, later, of course, even more so Chinese and other Asian immigrants. At the same time, however, it's also remarkable that until the 1870s and 1880s, there were very few federal government barriers to immigration. And although there were some set up by the states, those who were not welcome in some states had the option of going to others. So in that respect, there was tremendous equality and opportunity. And in some ways, the performance of the early republic in this area was actually better than ours today. They didn't have horrible immigration, detention, and deportation systems like we did today. They didn't turn away refugees fleeing horrendous oppression. They didn't have many of the other practices we have today. So I think there's a lot of areas where there has been moral progress in the United States since the founding era, the area of slavery, racial equality, gender equality, and so on. In the area of openness to immigration, we are actually today worse than they were.
So Professor Soman, you wrote, in fact, in 2019 in The Atlantic, that our immigration laws defy the Constitution and that immigration restrictions have been held to a far lower constitutional standard compared with almost any other exercise of government power. I'll give you a chance to talk a little more about why you think that's so. And you've given some great examples already of things that are tolerated today that would not have even been tolerated in the early republic in terms of inequality in the enforcement of immigration. But I guess what has brought us to this point?
It's been a long history, although a lot of it going back to the late 19th century when, as I said before, the Supreme Court first ruled that the federal government had a power to enact immigration restrictions. That in itself was a departure from the way other aspects of federal power were analyzed, in that in other areas, the court was generally reluctant, especially in that era, to ascribe to the federal government vast powers that were never anywhere specifically listed in the Constitution. Also during that same period, the Supreme Court began the adoption of what legal scholars called the plenary power doctrine, which is the idea that not only does Congress have the power to exclude immigrants, but its power is largely exempt from other constitutional constraints that apply to most other exercises of federal power, such as the need to respect due process, the need to avoid various kinds of discrimination, like discrimination on the basis of race or religion or freedom of speech, and so on. And that doctrine exists, at least to a considerable extent, in the Supreme Court's precedents. Even today, the most recent major example, you actually already mentioned, the 2018 travel ban decision, where even though Donald Trump, the president at the time, had repeatedly said that the immigration restrictions that he had imposed on near total entry ban on citizens of several Muslim majority nations, he had repeatedly said that the purpose of that was to target Muslims. Still, the Supreme Court chose to uphold it against a challenge arguing that this was discrimination based on religion, and they upheld it specifically because of the double standard that is applied to immigration policy. If something similar had happened in almost any other area of policy, they would have said, well, this is clearly discrimination on the basis of religion, and we strike it down. Indeed, just a couple weeks before the travel ban decision, they issued their decision in Masterpiece Cake Shop, which was about discrimination on the basis of religion in the state of Colorado. And there was considerably less evidence of discriminatory motivation in the travel ban case, but the Supreme Court, in a 7-2 ruling, nonetheless said there's discrimination here, it has to be struck down, whereas in the immigration case, they treated it very differently, precisely because it is immigration, and this is just one of a large number of areas where immigration policy, in effect, gets a free pass or almost a free pass from normal constitutional scrutiny by the courts.
Mm. Professor Rodriguez, in your book, The President and Immigration Law, you explain that there are a lot of separation of power questions at play when it comes to policing immigration. And you ask and explore the question of how immigration authority is distributed between the political branches. What are the biggest takeaways from your examination of that question? And how have those questions played out in real life?
So in the book by co-author Adam Cox and I broached the question of how can we explain why the president seems to exercise so much power over the shape of immigration law when Supreme Court opinion after Supreme Court opinion refers to the power to regulate immigration as being something that belongs to Congress. And the gist of the conclusion is that over the course of the 20th century, Congress and the executive together have created a massive deportation system. Ilya alluded to this before, something that didn't really exist in the 19th century, began to be built with the Chinese Exclusion Act. And over the course of the 20th century, Congress enacted more and more laws that made people deportable and funded a vast bureaucracy to make deportation actually happen. It's one thing to have legal authority to deport someone, but you also need the personnel and the resources to effectuate deportation. And that's something that was done in earnest over the course of the 20th century. That machinery in the beginning of the 1970s, but through the late 20th century, the beginning of the 21st, collided with massive illegal immigration, mostly from Mexico, but from all over the world, which resulted in the presence in the United States of a population of almost 12 million deportable non-citizens. So even with the vast deportation machinery that the president presides over, it was no longer possible to remove everyone who was removable under the law. And yet there was incredible pressure to do so. The same political economy that led to the rise of this deportation system also has resulted in an enforcement orientation to the immigration laws. But the consequence of all of these developments is that the executive branch and who's in charge in the White House has a lot to do with the shape of immigration policy. And it's the executive officials who work with the president who decide who gets to stay and who must be removed. And this is the origin story, in a sense, of the DACA policy. Where the Obama administration decided that this large group of non-citizens without status, people who were brought to the country when they were minors, who are functionally American and ought to be allowed to remain, should not be deported. And through the power to control the enforcement system, DACA was created. Of course, DACA has provoked a lot of legal controversy. I happen to believe it's fully legal and consistent with the kind of authority the system grants the president, but it only underscores how important who controls the presidency is to the shape of immigration policy. And there are numerous examples of this throughout the post-World War II period, and that continue to appear on the headlines as we speak.
We'll be right back with more Created Equal right after this. We've got two great experts with us this hour to help frame this conversation. Christina Rodriguez is a professor of law at Yale Law School. Her expertise includes constitutional law in theory and immigration law in policy. She's author of the book, The President and Immigration Law. Also with us is Ilya Soman, who is a professor of law at George Mason University. And his expertise includes constitutional law and migration rights. He's author of the book Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. I want to start this part of the conversation here with that question I just asked our listeners, which is, can America be America without being a welcoming place for newcomers? And I think the sort of natural extension of that question is, what would an immigration policy look like that was more welcoming? What would the framework be for a set of policies that brought us closer to that ideal that many of the founders had about what America would be? Professor Soman, I'll start with you.
So there's many things that we can do to bring us closer and live up to the ideal more fully. I think the ultimate goal, which I don't think is going to be achieved anytime soon, is to shift the current system where there's a presumption that migrants are kept out unless there's a specific law saying that they're let in, and shift it to the opposite presumption, which is that people should be allowed free entry unless there's some compelling evidence that they pose some sort of a threat, such as that they're planning to commit acts of terrorism or espionage or the like. Short of that, we can at the very least subject immigration restrictions to the same constitutional constraints that apply to virtually every other exercise of government power. For example, we should impose on that the same sort of restrictions that apply to other severe deprivations of liberty. That way we end such travesties as, for example, toddlers, quote unquote, representing themselves in immigration detention proceedings because they're not given any right to counsel. We should make clear that restrictions on racial, religious, ethnic and other kinds of discrimination that are forbidden in other areas of government policy are also forbidden when it comes to immigration policy. Similarly, that we cannot deport people or keep them out because the government disapproves of their speech and the like, which currently there are laws on the books which allow deportation or exclusion on that basis. There's a lot of other steps of that kind that we can take. And finally, even if we don't adopt a general presumption of freedom of movement, we can liberalize immigration policy so as to make legal entry easier on a lot of fronts. The main reason why we have an issue with illegal migration is because for the vast majority of the people who migrate illegally, it's simply not possible to enter any other way. So a vast illegal market naturally develops, just like the illegal market for alcohol when we had alcohol prohibition in the 1920s and early 1930s. And if we make it easier for people who want to work and live here to enter, that would eliminate most of the illegal immigration problem, and it would also make our economy vastly more productive. And we would save a lot of money on immigration enforcement as well.
Professor Rodriguez, I wonder if you can talk a little about this idea of fairness with regard to immigration and what that looks like. What does that mean? And how far, I guess, are we right now from having an immigration policy that reflects the kind of fairness that perhaps many of the founders expected?
That's a really big and difficult concept to unpack. Mm-hmm. I think in a very general sense, the United States and the system we have today is welcoming to immigrants in that more than a million non-citizens enter the country every year to become residents of the United States. And there are a number of different kinds of channels through which people may enter, including an asylum and refugee system that the current administration is trying mightily to revive after it was decimated by their predecessors. But there are also countless pockets of unfairness and arbitrariness in the system. One of them is something to which Ilya just alluded, which is that there are very prescribed ways in which people can enter the United States. Someone who wants to come here has to have either a family connection or fit into an employment category, after which there are not nearly enough visas, or be able to meet the exacting requirements of the asylum and refugee laws, which only apply to a limited number of people who are fleeing disaster or harm or violence or persecution from their countries of origin. So expanding the paths by which people might enter could make the system less arbitrary in the way that it selects people from other parts of the world. Our deportation system is also full of provisions that you might describe as unfair. So one of the ways to make this system both more fair and more humane and closer to the ideal that you're invoking is by radically restructuring our deportation laws, including by reducing the number of offenses, including very minor offenses that today would constitute grounds for removal, reintroducing something like a statute of limitations that once you've become a permanent resident of the United States, there's only a short period in which you become eligible for deportation. And, you know, beyond that, the idea of upgrading you from the country where you might have your family, your livelihood, and all of your personal ties because of a criminal offense seems earth-shattering and arguably inappropriate unless the offense is truly severe. It's also vital that the immigration system be more adaptable than it is now. Among the many reasons why the United States in the late 20th century developed this large illegal population is because of the inability of the system to adapt to the changing nature of migration flows, to changing labor market demands, and to changing interconnections between people in the United States and people elsewhere, and the inability to accommodate mixed status families, U.S. citizens who have relations who don't have legal status. And that adaptation, as Adam and I argue in our book, is something that we think requires actually involving the executive branch more by giving the president and executive agencies more power to look at the situation in the world and adapt the law to accommodate disasters in one place or the needs of the labor market of the United States in another or foreign policy considerations. And there are a lot of tools in the immigration law that have emerged precisely to fulfill those objectives, but they're not nearly good enough. And the result is a lot of people who ought to be accommodated in some way or another left out.
So, Christina, you say that Congress could address some of these issues by formally delegating power to the president to adjust these quotas and admissions criteria. Talk about what that would achieve and what the potential pitfalls, I guess, are of something like that. And are there some things that we should be concerned about, I guess, with that kind of a power? But I think it's a particularly interesting question to consider, given the very dramatic transition that we've just had from President Trump, which you've noted, to President Biden. Talk just a little about that idea of yours.
So the numbers and quotas that govern who can enter the United States are set by statute by Congress, and they really have changed very little in the last 30 to 40 years. And that has a lot to do with the complex and pitched politics surrounding immigration. It's extraordinarily difficult to enact immigration legislation, even when there's a lot of widespread support for it. I think the Congress's inability, for example, to enact the DREAM Act, which gives status to those who are eligible for DACA that was widely supported, still has not succeeded in becoming legislation. And that contributes in part to a system that does not have the capacity to adapt to what's happening in the world around it, to address refugee outflows, sudden crises, and shifts in the labor market. And the idea is that if you give some of that power to adjust the quotas for the numbers of immigrants who can enter the United States each year to reflect those kinds of changes, that would lead to a system that better matched the needs of the country as well as the pressures on its borders. All of this, of course, exists within a context of assuming that we need numerical quotas and the like, but that's been the way U.S. immigration law has been structured since the early 20th century. The pitfalls, I think you can see in the way that the Trump administration effectively undid refugee resettlement. That is one pocket where Congress has delegated power to the president to set the numbers of people who enter each year. The Refugee Act of 1980 Congress gave the president the authority to set the numbers of refugees who could be admitted. And the Trump administration reduced that number to near zero. And so that has led to a rethinking of whether certain baselines need to be established, that we have, as a country, a basic commitment to a certain amount of, say, refugee resettlement. And then beyond that, the president has the power to adapt upwards and to admit more if there are larger refugee crises than the baseline numbers would allow the system to accommodate. And so, as with any system or regulatory model where you delegate power to the president, if you have a president that is hostile to the goals of the underlying statute, then that can wreak havoc on the system. But that's not enough of a reason not to try to design a better system than the one that we have now that is incapable of reflecting and channeling the needs of a 21st century economy in an interconnected world.
Professor Soman, I wonder what you make of this proposal that Congress could delegate these powers to the president to adjust quota and admissions criteria. Is that a potential fix for some of the problems that we see in immigration?
So I sympathize with Christina's objectives in advocating this sort of system, but I have more reservations than she does that the best solution is to give more discretion to the president, and I think that's true for two reasons. One is, as Christina herself alluded, if you get a president, as of course we just had, who is deeply hostile to immigration, if he has the power to adjust quotas and other immigration restrictions, then he could use that power to severely restrict immigration, impose various injustices, and so forth. A second, more practical problem is that even the best-intentioned person in the White House, still I'm skeptical that any government can do a good job of trying to plan what is the right level of labor supply or what sorts of skills we should have in the economy. Instead of trying to centrally plan that, it's better to leave that up to market competition. If central planning of labor supply was a really great idea, the Soviet Union would have been a great success, and it clearly wasn't, because actually governments are very bad at planning these things. And then third, I think delegating so much power to one man or one woman in the White House is, I think, inimical to the idea of the rule of law, that if you have one person who gets to decide whether millions of people are going to have access to freedom and opportunity, or whether instead they're going to be kept out or deported or condemned to poverty for the rest of their lives, not only is that unfair and unjust, but it's also inimical to the idea of the rule of law, where at least important issues related to people's liberty and fundamental rights should be decided by laws that everybody is supposed to obey, that are known in advance, rather than by the will of one person who often make those decisions based on short-term political calculations. I don't think we can eliminate all executive discretion, either from this area of policy or most others, but I think we should at least reduce the vast amount of discretion that currently exists, where one person, based on their political calculations, literally holds the fate of millions of people in their hands. I think that's deeply at odds with the rule of law, and Congress and the courts should work to cut back on that.
We'll be right back with more Created Equal right after this.
Welcome back to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I've got two great guests with me. Christina Rodriguez is a law professor at Yale University. Ilya Soman is a law professor at George Mason University. And we're talking about immigration, the crisis that we face in immigration, and how history helps us unpack the questions that we are facing to figure out who should be an American. I want to start this part of the conversation here with a question about the political establishment and the current political system. It has stalled for many years now over the question of reforming immigration in a large sense. We've been deadlocked in Congress for almost a few decades over the question of how to do this. But is the current system capable of dealing with these immigration questions in a large way? Is Congress the wrong place, I guess, to think about where these kinds of questions can be resolved, given the current politics? Professor Somin, I'll start with you this time.
I think obviously both on this issue and on a lot of other issues, there's depolarization in Congress and in our political system more generally. I think that's pretty obvious. Anybody who follows politics knows that that is the case. At the same time, there are a number of reforms that actually do enjoy a considerable degree of bipartisan and public support, which could be enacted. Christina mentioned one of them, legalizing DACA and taking those several hundred thousand people or more and legalizing their status so it no longer depends on the whims of the president. Another area where there's a great deal of agreement is making various kinds of high-skill immigration easier. Could be expanded. I think there's also a lot of agreement, certainly not universal, but there is a great deal on letting in refugees who are threatened with serious suppression in their countries of origin. We saw that just now, an example of that, with the widespread willingness, including among many Republicans, to welcome Afghan refugees and those who helped support the U.S. effort there, and as a result now are threatened with oppression and persecution by the Taliban. I think also there's ways in which the courts and the executive could eliminate some of the shameful abuses that exist in the detention and deportation system. I think some elements on the more extreme right would be against doing that, but I think there could be at least a lot of support in majority public opinion for doing that as well. So I think there are some things which are extremely difficult, and there are some abuses and injustices which is going to take a long time to get rid of if we ever do. But there's also a lot of low-hanging fruit in immigration policy which Congress, the courts, and the executive could address and enjoy broad public support in doing so if they were willing to try. I think also there may be some reason to hope that the courts will take a slightly less hands-off attitude, at least on some issues. Just last fall, actually, a court struck down some of Donald Trump's late in his administration, his severe restrictions on employment visas on the grounds that the administration's interpretation of the law in question gave the executive so much power that it would violate constitutional principles against the delegation of congressional power to the executive. And I think similar principles could apply against some of the more extreme immigration restrictions imposed by the executive in other areas, including right now, perpetuated by the Biden administration with respect to so-called Title 42 expulsions at the border, which expel many hundreds of thousands of people on the pretext of combating the COVID pandemic. So there's a lot that could be done. There also are very serious political obstacles as well.
Professor Rodriguez, we've got about 2 minutes left. I wonder what you make of sort of alternative approaches to immigration reform. Here in Michigan, for instance, we had a governor recently who decided that he was going to do things a little differently on his own and not wait for Congress. Is that the solution going forward?
I do think that actors in states, governors, mayors, advocacy organizations at the local level who see the benefits from immigration are critical voices in the immigration debate. And those kinds of actors have always been helping to set the agenda, both in a manner that calls for more and fairer immigration and more humane immigration policy, but also in the restrictionist sense. And so empowering local lawmakers without consideration of what the end goal might be could backfire, but it is critical for those who do the work of integration on the ground and who are trying to build communities and understand how vital immigrants are in many of those communities to be proposing bold initiatives. And there are other models in the world, Canada, for example, where the provinces have a role to play in helping to define what the needs are at a moment in time, and that shapes the immigration policy at a given moment in time.
So, Stephen, I think that this was a helpful conversation to hear you speak with them, but I don't know that I feel any better about immigration.
I don't either, and yeah. I don't think anyone could listen to that conversation and feel better about what's going on. I think the value here is in understanding a little more about it, and certainly right. in knowing the history. I do think that it's interesting that that both Ilya Soman and Christina Rodriguez struggle with mm-hmm. what should happen now, how you should not only interpret the Constitution to decide what should happen, but also to interpret the current moment, right, which looks really different from what the founders were thinking about when they wrote all of that.
It's also trying to determine how much of our politics is about the politicians and what they want versus what the people of America have been wanting, right? How much immigration is going to get moved and decided upon, even though we know that that's something we want to get handled, right?
There's no question. Yeah. Yeah. Do it, right?
Get it done.
Any poll you do on immigration supports a broad approach to reforming the system. You know, people want the law enforced. They also want opportunity preserved, right? Most people believe that you should have a legal path to be coming to this country and becoming a citizen, and it shouldn't be difficult, and it shouldn't be determined, by where you're from. Mm-hmm. But getting to that point in Congress is just nearly impossible, and we're watching that happen right now as Congress has this really great compromise worked out. But it won't pass because the pressure from the outside is to deny President Biden a win or to wait until they think a Republican's in and do something else. I mean, the politics always get in the way of this issue.
Wow. And it's such an important issue, as we talked about at the beginning. It's crucial to who we are. You would think that's something that we could find some common ground on when there's very few things that we find common ground on in American politics nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people have fear about this issue, right? Fear of lost opportunity themselves, fear of change, cultural change that comes from immigration. And I think that ends up driving a lot of the anxiety about what we see with the number of people coming and coming without a legal path.
When you say fear of lost opportunity themselves, you mean jobs that may go to folks
jobs,
who come in that they aren't getting?
Right. A loss of money through taxes to support families who come here who need short-term support. And all of that is very short-sighted and doesn't take into context, you know, who the people are who are coming and what they could offer us. I mean, here in the state of Michigan, for instance, we're talking about we need more population. We need population growth. Massive population growth. Well, where would that come from if not from immigration? But a lot of people feel like those immigrants that you might welcome would burden the system too much, for instance, and take money from them to do it or create overcrowding. Not that we have those concerns in Detroit, right?
Right.
But
tons of space.
Yeah, there's plenty of space. And that's the attitude we need to get more people to embrace, is that there is plenty here. These immigrants could contribute to the things that we want to grow and cherish. We just gonna need to find a legal way for them to be here.
Sounds good. Another good episode in the books.
Yes, another episode in the books. On to the next one. That'll do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at wdet.org, and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Additional production support comes from Jack Philbrant. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.